Morning, council. Ready to proceed?
Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, and may it please the court. My name is Bernard O'Donnell. I'm here on behalf of Vicki Chow, the appellant in this matter. I know the court is familiar with the procedural history, so I'll not review it in much detail. In any event, our contention here is that this court's decision in 2003 in the Williams versus State case, essentially narrowing the scope of the felony murder statute, or recognizing that it had a more narrow application than had been applied in the past, should be applied to benefit Ms. Childs, as in this case. When Ms. Chow was originally convicted of felony murder, she argued that the conviction should not stand for felony murder because the murder was not in furtherance of the commission of the felony, because the state alleged all along that it was her intent to commit murder during the commission of arson. Now, in the Williams case, the court took another look at the law and recognized that that was so, and gave Joseph Williams the benefit of that decision. We're asking for that here this morning, too, that Ms. Chow should have the benefit of the view of the law that was promulgated, says in Williams. There are two factors in this case that are really not in dispute.
Before we get to the merits of that argument, what would the implication be? A new trial with that instruction at the new trial, or what's the relief you're seeking?
Well, it would be, first of all, it would be remanded to the Superior Court for further consideration, because it was a limited remand, but actually says a vacation of the felony murder conviction. One of the reasons why substantive rules are often applied, are applied retroactively on post-conviction relief, is that by virtue of the narrowances of the rule, there isn't a retrial. So the prospects of the problems of new trial, finding witnesses again years later, this and that, one of the arguments for finality being imposed doesn't exist where the scope of a criminal statute is recognized as narrow enough that the offense was not committed.
Are you suggesting that we should preclude the state from a new trial if they decide that, you know, the evidence does support this new interpretation?
Yes, because under the, it says the Williams case, the state didn't get the benefit of a new trial, it says in Williams, to retry him again.
Is that a concession?
It's not a concession. It was the recognition that that under the facts of the case, the offense of felony murder has not been committed. So there's no point in having a new trial if the offense of felony murder has not been committed under the facts of the case.
So if you're saying there's nothing in the record that would support an amended indictment if the state chose to seek one?
No, we did not believe so. It was the state's position all along that the arson was committed in order to cause the deaths. And therefore, under the Williams case, the felony murder rule does not apply.
Well, what about elimination of witnesses? Would that be a felony murder?
Well, the elimination of a witness would be an intentional homicide, and Williams would does apply. Joseph Williams, I guess, intended to eliminate as a witness, the victim, as of the offense. And that was considered, I think, an aggravating circumstance in the Williams case originally.
Well, why don't you go ahead with your two points, and we can ask Mr. Myers what he thinks the implications are in the event that you prevail and the rule does apply retroactively.
The two points I'd just like to recite are, it says, number one, the state does not contest here that this is a substantive rule rather than a procedural rule that is being asked to be disapplied. And the state does not contest that she was convicted of, it says the felony, it says murder. Now, what the state does contest here is that the substantive rule, or really the interpretation of the substantive law, should not be applied, that it can't be applied under Delaware's post-conviction rule. Delaware's post-conviction rule has a long history, although it's a fairly, as modern as rule, the court has had an opportunity, both this court and the Superior Court, to take a look at it as many times. The post-conviction rule has often, has usually been applied to give defendants the benefit of interpretations, new interpretations of criminal law. It happened in the Bailey case back in the late 80s, the weapons offense and substantive offense. In addition to, I'd like to point out, says at this point, the Flamer case. The court considered the application of the of a procedural rule in Flamer, an Edwards claim, and whether that should be applied, says retroactively. The court considered the body of federal law, too, in construing Delaware's own post-conviction rule in Flamer. And the court found, the Superior Court first, and then this court affirmed, that the procedural rule should not be applied, says retroactively, under Delaware's post-conviction rule. One of the interesting things about that case is that although the state now contends that substantive rule interpretation of a statute should not be retroactively applied, I'd ask the court to consider, says the text of a prior writing on this matter. And this is it, quote, only one narrow exception to the preclusion of post-conviction relief based on subsequent legal developments has emerged. Collateral attack is permissible when the new ruling determines that the conduct of the previously convicted defendant is immune from any criminal sanction or cannot be the subject of the punishment imposed earlier. Now, where is that from? That is from the state's answering brief in Flamer in 1990. In 1990, the state examined Delaware's post-conviction rule and said that in that procedural rules could not be retroactively applied, but substantive interpretations of law could be retroactively applied under Delaware's post-conviction rule. The state also said relitigation of a previously resolved claim is permitted only when subsequent legal developments have revealed that the trial court lacked the authority to convict or punish the defendant. That's at pages 18 and 19 of the state's brief. So in Flamer, it was safe or convenient for the state to concede in that case that substantive interpretations of law could be retroactively applied. In this case, they disclaim their prior assertion in Flamer. And we do not believe that that's a fair interpretation of Delaware's post-conviction rule if it is to be applied as a consistent body of law. Delaware's consistently followed the federal jurisprudence. Granted, it's a difference as rule. They're both elements of the conviction rule are modeled on, there's a model post-conviction rule. But Flamer specifically referenced Davis versus United States. In the state's briefing, they try to say, oh, well, it's a signal problem. It was just a reference, et cetera. But the states has adopted Davis in their argument in Flamer. It wasn't dicta, only dicta from this court or the Superior Court. It was the state that argued that a substantive interpretation of law can be retroactively applied, and only that. The state also argues that this is a non-constitutional rule of criminal law, and non-constitutional rules need not be retroactively applied. In some sense, this is in fact a, in a very real sense, this is in fact a constitutional rule because there's no more constitutional rule than that a defendant cannot be convicted unless the evidence proves his or her guilt beyond reasonable doubt, the Winship principle. In the state has argued that, well, this court does not take the, this court actually promulgated a new law in Williams. We don't believe that is so. The court interpreted the law, took a closer look at it, and arrived at a different analysis of the law. In the Evans case, the court, in fact, paralleled what it did, says in Williams, quote, to declare what the law is or has been is a judicial power. This isn't any new rule it's a new rule in the sense that it's an interpretation, but it's not a new statute or anything else. It's the court's judicial power to interpret the law. And that's what the court did in Williams, and that's what we're asking to be applied here. Now,
there's no legislative change since Williams.
Yes, there has. The General Assembly says remove the inference as requirement under the law. There's a complicated history under the common law as for that requirement. I won't go into that, but the General Assembly says mooted the questions as there by removing says that element under the statute subsequent to Williams. Now, insofar as
the implication of that is we now have a finite group of people that would be affected by any holding that's retroactive.
Yes, sir. I know that there is, insofar as this case, I'm familiar with one other case in Kent County, which I think is pending now in Superior Court, and the decision has been stayed in Superior Court pending resolution of this legal issue. In that case, I think it's a robbery case and a weapons offense, and in addition, there are a few other decisions, not necessarily insofar as this, the Williams case, but retroactive applications of the Poteet decision and the Williams decision. Williams was the basis of the Superior Court's reversal of the murder convictions in court in Kirk, the Kirk case, which the court asked.
Do you know how many other defendants would be affected by this?
I am aware of, I think, only one. There may be another one. There may be two. It's a limited.
The answer to my question is no, you don't know how many, but you're aware of one.
Yes, sir.
Is that correct?
Yes.
The reason I ask is I can remember when it was represented to us in another case that what we were left to believe would be a few people would be affected. We were later treated to a press conference where it was announced that it was over 200 people. It would be affected. So I'm trying to get a handle on how many people. And I think that's why Justice Holland asked for was there a finite amount?
Yeah. I remember that press conference at 200. I think that was a little bit of an interim says estimate, but that's moot at this point.
But it's in mind.
Sorry, sir?
But it's in mind.
Yes, sir. But we don't think that should ever be a controlling consideration insofar as, and I'm not trying to lecture the court at all, insofar as a application of the law. In the state's argument in this regard, it's almost like, well, you know, too much justice is not desirable. We ask the court to apply the law, you know, without consideration of whether, in quantitative terms, too many people will benefit. We don't think there are very many.
And hopefully, nothing that I said, and certainly nothing Justice Holland said, could be catched in terms of concern about too many people benefiting from the correct application of the law. It's not what
I think it's a finite number. In addition to, the state has presented exaggerated, I think, the consequences of it by arguing that, this will overturn so many plea bargains, et cetera. I don't think that will come into consideration at all. The Downer decision makes it very clear where Downer remained convicted of an offense that was not an offense, actually, but he had made his plea bargain, as with the state. And most of the cases the state refers to, the scores of cases here, are plea bargain cases, and Downer would prevent consideration under the post-conviction rule of overturning those decisions. There are There are one or two other cases. The Poteet decision was a robbery first, then aggravated menacing. The court determined in that decision that actually robbery first degree and aggravated menacing were included offenses, or aggravated menacing was an included offense of robbery first.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
Yes, sir. With one other point, as I'd like to mention, there was also the Crawford and McGriff, the retroactive application of the Crawford decision in McGriff.
Well, Mr. O'Donnell, before you sit down, help us understand the distinction you were making between substantive rules and procedural rules. As I understand it, under Teague, which is not binding on state courts can either decide to follow Teague or not with regard to procedural rules. Are you saying here that because this is a substantive rule and that we need to apply it retroactively, or is it also an option for state courts?
I think there's a very strong argument that it is required to be applied as retroactively because it's, even as a federal rule or federal decision, although they haven't expressly addressed that, it's certainly suggested in a number of decisions, but it's required to be applied as retroactively as a constitutional principle, as
based
a derivation.
Based on Davis?
Based on Davis.
So your argument comes down to what you said earlier, and the state concedes this is a matter of substance, not procedure, so we're not looking at state court discretion under Teague. If it is a substantive interpretation of a statute pursuant to Davis, it must be applied retroactively.
Yes, sir. And in addition, the state conceded in Flamer and contended before the court that substantive rules like this can be applied retroactively under Delaware's post-conviction rule. Why should the law change now?
The substance-procedure distinction, though, standing alone isn't magic. It has to be tethered to some policy. To be more precise, isn't it a more accurate statement that a substantive change will qualify for possible retroactive treatment, but it won't automatically receive retroactive treatment unless the result of the substantive change is to make the conduct not is to decriminalize the conduct.
In effect, that's what it does. It decriminalizes the conduct under the new interpretation of the law.
In this case.
Under which it must be applied retroactively. If the court permits, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. For the record, Mr. Myers appearing on behalf of the state. Last fall, I stood at the same podium and engaged in argument or discussion with the court in the Samuel case about principles of retroactivity. The question then was whether this court's decision in Torshiro Priest should be applied retroactively to benefit Mr. Samuel. The case was eventually disposed on other grounds. The court didn't have to reach the retroactivity issue presented in Samuel. I suppose, in the words of Mr. Berra, it's deja vu all over again. I am aware of at least four other defendants in the same boat as Ms. Chow. First and foremost would be Ms. Chow's co-defendant, Mr. Liu. Mr. Liu admittedly has not filed the post-conviction motion raising the Williams claim, but certainly if Ms. Chow gets relief, I might be hard-pressed to argue that Mr. Liu shouldn't get the same relief.
Well, your office stood before the Superior Court in the Dick case and argued.
I'm sorry, in which case?
Your office stood before the Superior Court in the Dick case, Judge Abelman's case.
Kirk.
Yes. I misspoke. And basically argued the position that Mr. O'Donnell is arguing here. If that was fair, why isn't it equally, if not more fair, for Ms. Chow, whose case changed the law, to get the same benefit?
this touches on the estoppel issue that's running throughout the case, throughout this case.
Well, putting estoppel to one side, why, you know, why as a matter of fairness should we entertain an opposite position, even if you're not technically precluded by some estoppel principle? What's the justice in it?
It's prosecutors make decisions based on what they think the law is at, or what they understand the law to be at any given point.
So was there a misunderstanding in the Kirk case? Or is there a misunderstanding now?
Well, since I was involved in the discussions in the Kirk case, I think I can say that we didn't fully understand the retroactivity principles that we thought we understood. And that was why we reached the decision we did in the Kirk case. We went back and thought about this some more and decided that that as we understood the law now, as articulated in the briefing before this court, that Williams did not have to be applied retroactively to Chow.
How does that, that was then, this is now approach, create a just result in the case of Ms. Chow, whose case again was responsible for the substantive reinterpretation of the statute?
Somebody is always going to be on the wrong side of the line. And if we want, if the goal is to achieve some optimum position of total absolute fairness, then every decision, whether it involves a substantive rule, procedural rule, something in between, some hybrid, every decision has to be applied retroactively, because somebody's always going to fall on the wrong side of the line.
How would you describe what we said about the Chow decision in Williams? What did Williams say about the Chow decision?
Well, it explicitly overruled the Chow court's interpretation of the in furtherance language. I mean, it's, I mean, there's no doubt about it. It's, it says it is a Chow, the relevant portion of Chow is overruled. It's not, you know, somehow some additional gloss or, you know, interpretation along the margins. I mean, it's flat out, that part of Chow is flat out overruled.
So if the Williamson court had been hearing that same day the Chow appeal, it would have reversed, correct?
If Chow's case was on direct appeal, yes, then the usual rules of retroactivity as articulated in the Capano case on direct appeal would apply.
Okay. What would have happened? It would have been reversed and remanded for a new trial. Is that right?
My recollection is that Williams' felony murder conviction was vacated because we couldn't prove furtherance.
Can you do that in this case, or are you prepared to answer that question today?
My recollection of the facts in Chow's case and right now leads me to think we could not prove the in furtherance element. That means Chow would get an acquittal on felony murder. But as illustrated by the Kirk case, we could proceed on a manslaughter theory.
All right. Would that be as a lesser-included offense or a new indictment?
That would be as a lesser-included offense. I think Kirk makes that. This between Judge Abelman's decision in Kirk and this court's affirmance in Kirk, that makes that pretty clear, that it's that it proceeds as a lesser-included offense.
Is it your position that we should decide the retroactive application or remand it to Superior Court because Superior Court has decided nothing more than that the state is not a stop from making the argument?
I read Judge Scott's opinion be pretty clear that Ms. Chow got the would get the retroactive application of Williams. It went back to Judge to Superior Court, and Judge Scott was assigned to the case because Judge Gebline obviously had left. Went back to Superior Court for further explanation, development of rationale for the particular decision. And at that point, the parties were involved in supplemental briefing and so forth.
What case do you rely on for the proposition that our court has discretion to decide whether a substantive change in the law applies retroactively as opposed to whether it's mandatory? Mr. O'Donnell cites Davis in support of his argument.
Davis versus United States is no more and no less a case about federal post-conviction procedure. It has nothing to do with constitutional requirements about retroactivity or anything like that. It's just, can Mr. Davis use the federal post-conviction procedure to get back into federal court to litigate a claim that had been decided on direct appeal?
Well, that distinguishes Davis ostensibly, but as I said in my question to Mr. O'Donnell, Teague is pretty clear that it's not binding on state courts. When we're talking about procedural rules, state courts can adopt their own position with regard to retroactivity in post-conviction proceedings. Now, my question is, what authority do you rely on to say that we have that same discretion with regard to the retroactivity of substantive rules?
As I wrote in the initial answering brief, the Nevada Supreme Court in the Clem case dealt with a similar situation, and there it was their interpretation of possession of a deadly weapon statute. And they went through the analysis, and they decided that they did not have to apply there was obviously some sort of intervening decision that limited the scope of the weapon statute. They decided they were not required by the federal Constitution to apply that intervening decision retroactively to Mr. Clem, who would have gotten.
Well, what's the rational basis for saying to Ms. Chow that notwithstanding the fact that this court in Williams concluded the construction of the statute in her very case was incorrect, she doesn't get the benefit of that ruling?
And I suppose I have to just fall back on what I said earlier. Retroactivity and where you draw the line, somebody's always going to be on the wrong side of the line. Now, is that a, to use your Honor's word, a rational explanation? I suppose that's as rational as I can approach.
It sounds like this is a roll of the dice and somebody's always in the wrong end of the roll. Let me follow up for a moment, if I may, on the Chief Justice's question. Judge Scott, as you understand it, ruled that the that Ms. Chow is eligible for the retroactive application of Williams to her case. But there was no order entered implementing that ruling, correct? That is, there was no actual vacation of the felony murder conviction or any order that would trigger or that would necessarily require this court to do any more than review in the abstract what Judge Scott held. Is that correct?
That's correct. And I think that's because of the, I suppose, the procedural posture in which it went back down to Superior Court. It was remanded, in fact, for Judge Scott to, I suppose, decide anew the issues that have been, excuse me, presented by Ms. Chow in the post-conviction motion.
Well, would that be required here? Would we have to remand to Judge Scott to enter a formal order vacating the conviction in order for us to be procedurally in a posture to rule on the retroactivity issue, or can we do it without a remand?
It strikes me that if the court affirms Judge Scott's interpretation and application of Williams, then the case goes back to Superior Court with instructions to,
I understand, but in order to affirm, you have to have an order to affirm. And my what you're telling me is there is no order yet.
Well, if this might help. The order originally appealed from was Judge Gebelein's order back in, like, the summer of 2004. So so it strikes me that that order would have to be reversed. In the process, the court would affirm or adopt Judge Scott's application and interpretation of Williams, and I suppose then it would just go back to Superior Court for further proceedings not inconsistent with this court's decision.
I'm glad Justice Jacobs followed up, because I'm not sure my question was answered. And at the apologies to my colleagues, because it may sound like this is how many angels are dancing on the head of a pin, but there is no holding from Superior Court that I can find. The conclusion that Judge Scott comes to is, first, as he puts it, the Superior Court is required to consider Chow's felony murder conviction in light of Williams. Second, the state is not a stop from arguing against the retroactive application of Williams. Now, if the conclusion is that Williams applies, and if the conclusion is that Chow is to benefit from a ruling favorable to her, why is the second finding one that the state can argue against it? I don't follow that. If he rules that the state is not estopped, as he apparently did, why doesn't that come first? And then he concludes that he must apply Williams to Chow. And here is the result. It is so ordered. I don't follow it. I'm confused. You're suggesting I should look at the text of his opinion and conclude from that, regardless of his conclusion, that he has affirmatively ruled that Williams is applicable and Chow has the benefit of that decision.
Yes.
We can rule on the substance of its applicability here, whether it's retroactive or not.
Yes, and I suppose the phrasing or the order in which Judge Scott writes his decision might have been influenced by the court's order, by this court's order remanding the case back down. because...
It looks to me like he saw, well, here's two questions from the Supreme Court. I'm going to answer them, and that's it. And even, and he didn't finish. So that we're back to, we've got the benefit of his thinking on those two questions. But we're really just back to where we were before the remand, reviewing Judge Gebbein's order, because there's nothing else that's a final order.
Well, I suppose my view of...
The easy thing is this issue teed up for us or not? Yes or no? Should we go forward and decide it based on the state of the record or not?
My answer is yes. There's nothing more to be decided in my mind, because the last paragraph in the first part of Judge Scott's opinion, before he talks about estoppel, I mean,
well, that's all I personally need to know, because you're the one that would benefit from the language that you're not estopped from making the further argument on remand. And if you can basically conclude, and it's easy to say it's an efficient way of handling it, that we can go forward and decide it, then that's good enough for me. Because I seriously question whether Mr. O'Donnell will differ from that.
Exactly. The court asked Mr. O'Donnell about implications of ruling in Ms. Chow's favor. I just want to point out that the statutory language at issue in Williams dated back to the, I believe, the 1974 criminal code. So,
and after our decision in Williams, your office had the statute amended.
That's correct, Your Honor. So as the court pointed out in his questioning of Mr. O'Donnell, there is a finite cap.
And how many people do you think would be affected by a retroactive application of this substantive rule? You mentioned two, Ms. Chow and her co-defendant.
I know two others, Arthur Govan, who is Dwayne Leake's co-defendant, and Luis Cabrera for the first homicide conviction. I think I write at some point, it might be in the initial answering brief, if there are, you know, somewhere between 40 and 50 homicides a year, and if you generously assume that only half of those turn out to be first degree murder cases, in contrast to manslaughter or something like that, and then maybe another half or half of that turn out to be felony murder cases, in contrast to intentional murder, multiply that out by, you know, 1974 to 2003, and that gives you, again, based on my back of the envelope calculations, a potential population of 300 inmates, and then somebody would have to go through the particular files and so forth, to discern whether, in fact, there'd be a basis for relief under Williams and...
Well, aren't most felony murder convictions accompanied by an intentional murder conviction, or not?
I know a lot of them are, but a lot of them are not.
You would think that with a case of this magnitude and an issue of this magnitude, we wouldn't be looking at the numbers based on a back of the envelope calculation.
That's a I accept that criticism.
Well, it's an observation. I mean, I'm surprised that, you know, with a case of this magnitude and an issue of this magnitude, that there hasn't been any comprehensive analysis.
I have no explanation for that except that nobody asked that any analysis be done, and I take the responsibility for that.
Is that an analysis that would take a long time to do? Or?
In contrast to the situation in Evans, where it was easy to identify the people who had parolable life sentences. It was just a matter of checking the prisoner list. In this situation, somebody would have to go back and look at the indictments because, you know, it's not, you know, if you look on the docket sheet, it just says, generally, first-degree murder. It doesn't specify any subsection.
So it would be a time-consuming case-by-case study.
Yes. Exactly. It's not something you can do in a morning, for example. I'd like to think the briefs otherwise explain the state's position. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Thank you.
We do not share Mr. Myers's concern that there are a deluge of cases out there that are going to unjustly benefit from a favorable decision to Ms. Chow. He suggested that, well, we'd have to go through a lot of files. You know, why go through files? I mean, who's filed already for post-conviction relief? I think there are very, very few. There aren't many at all. And these decisions that we're asking for the retroactive application of are already a few years old. I think under Delaware's post-conviction rule, even if somebody says wakes up now and says, I want the benefit of Chow, and they file today, they're defaulted under our post-conviction rule. So you're saying that
someone who was on notice of our holding in Williams and waited more than 3 years to file their application would be procedurally defaulted?
Well, since I don't have that client now, Your Honor, I think I can concede that. But if I did have a client in that circumstance, you'd have me.
Well, we've become more familiar with inconsistent arguments since this case anyway, so it shouldn't trouble us.
And as to that, Your Honor, the court was asking Mr. Myers for a principle of where there's any example where a substantive rule has been applied, says retroactively, in post-conviction relief, and the state has assisted in that. And I go back to the Flamer case and the briefing in the Flamer case and the state's answering brief. The state itself pointed out two cases, Bailey versus State at 422 Atlantic 2nd, where the defendant was given the benefit of an interpretation of the law merging the weapons offense and underlying offense.
In the Peaches Bailey case?
Yes, sir, John Bailey. And the second case is State versus Hicks at 459 Atlantic 2nd, 531, where post-conviction relief was permitted on a claim that the statute defining the offense was unconstitutional. The state has provided, says, those examples of illustrations of where substantive rules may be retroactively applied in Flamer 17 years ago. Why should the law not be the same now? What the state is, in a sense, contending here, it's interesting. I heard a comment that says roll of the dice. The state is contending now that, well, you know, Flamer, we just can't be happy with that, what we said in Flamer in 1990 and how the court has interpreted the post-conviction rule. Let's go to Nevada because Delaware doesn't work.
Well, as I understood your brief, in post-conviction proceedings in the federal court, the state argues for Delaware to follow the federal rules. And this if the federal rules applied in this case, Chao would get the benefit of the retroactivity. So this would be a departure from those arguments also.
Yes, sir. If the court has no further questions, I can waive the remainder of my time.
Well, I'd just like you to comment on Mr. Myers' statement that there would be a lesser included offense under Kirk. But in other words, it's not, if you, your arguments prevail here, it's not game over. It's a remand for at least the opportunity for the state to pursue any lesser included offense under felony.
In listening to the court's questions, I sort of anticipated that Your Honor says might ask that question when you were questioning, says Mr. Myers. And it's true that Judge Scott didn't finally resolve, says all this, that Judge Scott literally answered the court's questions, which is what a good judge does. So in that sense, there hasn't been a final answer with respect to that. Arguably speaking, could this, based upon the procedural state of the case at this point, could the state argue that she could still be prosecuted for manslaughter? As a matter of procedure, they could contend that now, says on remand. Whether the court is certainly, insofar as the retroactivity question per se, only that alone, that has not been finally. Judge Scott decided it, says in the interim. The court, in its decision, of course, could interpret the.
Your answer is that if there were, if we were to find that there was retroactivity, the felony murder conviction were vacated, the case is remanded, there's nothing that would bar the state from proceeding to prosecute on manslaughter.
Representing Ms. Chao, I think there would be something to bar the state. There'd be some principles that, I could raise.
But from our perspective, if we apply the rule retroactively and we remand it for further proceedings in accordance or consistent with our holding in Williams, then everybody makes their argument on the implication from Williams.
That is my understanding, Your Honor.
Do you recall in the last trial, were there instructions on lesser-included offenses?
I do not recall. I'd have to check on that. In addition, Williams was not prosecuted for his manslaughter, but in any event, insofar as Judge Scott's decision on the retroactivity question, I guess he did literally answer the court's questions. But if the state was right insofar as the retroactivity question, it could still be estopped based upon the independent question of, estoppel. So I guess it was proper then for him to answer those two questions as he did. And insofar as retroactivity and the scope of its application on substantive rules in Williams, if the state's so concerned about the consequences of retroactivity or the evils of retroactivity, why did they give the benefit to, says Mr. Kirk? They gave the benefit of the Williams decision to Mr. Kirk, not Ms. Chao, in the Poteet decision, which was the aggravated menacing and weapons offense merger. The state gave the benefit of that to three defendants in the Superior Court, Morillo, Carter, and Harris. Poteet was retroactively applied in those cases in the Superior Court in their unreported decisions, Morillo, Carter, and Harris. Insofar as the retroactivity of Crawford in the McGriff decision, now I know I conceded that eventually, but the state gave the benefit of that decision to a fellow named Mark Bruce in the Superior Court.
Thank you, Mr. O'Donnell.
Thank you.
I'll take the case under advisement and assess.